Holy shit, guys. Today is, I'm really excited about this interview because the story is like, whoa. And it came about really, I guess the way all good things do, from rather left field. So I'd had two interviews booked for this week so I could get a little ahead. And instead of running like last minute like I usually do. And both fell through, and I needed to get an interview recorded pretty much today. Mabel was homesick with me yesterday, so that wrote that day off. And I needed to find someone ASAP. So I posted in my shop speak up group, does anyone have any connections to someone who would have a really interesting story? And I got a bunch of great responses, a bunch of great guests coming up. But one of the girls or women, Melissa Zammit, in there said, can it be a male? I know an emotion coach that learnt a lot of his life lessons and how to overcome negative emotions in prison. It's a fascinating story of how he turned his life around and now helps others. And I was like, wow, that does sound like an interesting story. And it's probably about time I got another guy on. Different perspective, you know. So I jumped at the chance, locked it in, and holy shit, this story just blows my mind. I'm not going to give too much away. Mel said it pretty good, right? He was in jail. He learned a lot of his lessons while he was in jail. And I found this whole thing really fascinating because he's literally been in prison. And most of us are imprisoned in our own minds. We're still living in a prison, but it's just not four physical walls and 1 hour of daylight. So strap yourself in, enjoy. Let me introduce you to the incredible. I cannot wait to see where this guy goes. He's got two books in the wings, and I mean, whoa, like he is going places. Let me introduce you to Scott Franklin. Welcome to Carlosophy's Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
Started off in Helensburgh, which is very southern Sydney. Pretty not normal childhood by most standards, but there's a few challenges that I did suffer from, and there's a thing that happened to me when I was really young of a sexual nature, and I didn't realize how much it affected me probably until later years, because when it happened I was quite confused and I didn't know, too young to really know what I was doing. But anyway, it led to a lot of depression and really low self-esteem. And these emotions got trapped in my body for such a long time. And I was so fearful about telling anyone about this for so long that it was just kind of like this big, big demon that I kept, you know, hidden away in these boxes in my mind somewhere, hoping that it would never come out one day. So that there probably prevented me from growing and developing like on a social level and on a spiritual level for quite a long time. I was good at school, like I did well, like with my grades were all good and I was good at sports. But where I really started to sort of notice these effects was when in social type situations. I didn't know what to say or how to act. I didn't know how to read social situations and just feel a vibe of a room or feel what another person's feeling because I was so stuck up in my head. And I feel the reason that I was stuck up in my head and then during that phase of my life is because I was too fearful to go into my emotion body. The emotions would have been far too painful for me to know how to digest them or to process them. So this ended up leading to a lot of social anxiety during probably my high school years. But again, doing really well at school, academic-wise, sport-wise, did all right. And no one probably would have been able to tell that I was suffering from low self-esteem and depression because I presented myself quite differently. And since I've talked to people about it in later years, they're like, far out, like we never imagined that you would have been going through that. And I was like, yeah, you know, like I feel like I just felt things more, probably more intensely than others. Like in hindsight, I just feel that you know, rejections and knockbacks and things like that, they were really painful for me, and they seemed to stick around for quite a long time. So I was quite fearful of putting myself out there into social situations, you know, just in fear of not being accepted, being rejected and all that kind of stuff. But then it was kind of like, you know, you got to make these big life decisions when you're in high school, you know, what do you want to be when you get older and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just thinking, how are we meant to know this? Because we don't have any life experiences to base it on. So we're just going off these theories and concepts in our head. So I kind of just followed a natural progression. I was always good at health. I did really well at human movement at school. So it was just a natural progression for me to kind of follow down that health track. And also considering when I was younger, I was also a chubby kid. And when I was looking at the people that I felt were the most happy and the most confident were the older guys, my older friends, who were all, you know, sporty, big guys, really lean and all that kind of stuff. They seemed to be having the most fun in life. So I thought, well, being athletic and big and lean must be the answer to my confidence problem. So that just fed me more, made me more hungry to figure out, you know, this whole nutrition and weight loss type thing. So that really drove me to sort of get the marks that I needed to get into uni. So when I got into uni, like you find the answers that you're looking for, and you quickly find out that it's not done through exercise. I remember sitting in the third year lecture theatre, and the lecturer said to us, most of us, when you finish this degree, you're going to be working with people in the weight loss and the health industry, and you're gonna need to know that it's not really done through exercise. And I remember thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing sitting here in a third year lecture theatre? I've got this huge hex debt that I've got to pay off and all this kind of stuff. And anyway, they said the answer is through more nutrition. So I really started to focus more on my nutrition. And it wasn't so much through reading textbooks and learning things. I just spent time with people that knew what they were doing, you know, like experts in that field. And I had friends that were studying nutrition, friends that were studying dietetics, friends that were doing bodybuilding and all that kind of stuff. So I've always been a very curious person, because I've always been quite vocal about what I'm struggling with, because I just want to know the answers. And so I just absorb information off them and try it. And I noticed that my body started to transform more with the nutrition than it did with the exercise. Finished the degree, and then I'm like, all right, where's my job? And they're like, well, you don't get a job. You're an exercise scientist. And I'm going, well, why did I just do this, you know, 3-4 year degree to have no job at the end? Like, why wasn't this explained to me? Like, if I missed something here, I was like, you know, I listened to the teachers at school. You know, they said, study hard, go to uni, go to uni, you'll end up get a job, you'll be a millionaire by the time you're mid to late 20s. And I found it to be the exact opposite. I had a huge hex debt. I was overqualified in an area that you don't need to know. To be a personal trainer, you can do a 6-week course and be a qualified personal trainer. You don't need to go to uni for 3 or 4 years. So anyway, I ended up buying a gym while I was still at uni in Helensburg. It went really well to begin with. Like, technically, I was very good. I knew my stuff. I looked the part, so I walked the talk. I was good at connecting with the clients. But where I really started to struggle was probably more of the business side of things. Like, I didn't have the right systems in place to make the business function properly. I lacked emotional intelligence. I didn't know how to keep myself motivated for long periods of time. Plus, also, the social anxiety was starting to get more and more, because it was at that phase where, like, a lot of my mates left high school at year 10, 11 or 12, and they got trades, and they're now third or fourth year apprentices or, you know, qualified tradesmen, starting to make good money, starting to get cars, apartments, going overseas holidays, and I'm still, you know, scraping the coin jar just to get myself through the weeks. Yeah, I just felt like I was falling further and further behind, which led to more depression. So I just kept layering on top of itself, more depression, more of the social anxiety, more of the low self-esteem. And in the personal training world, it's, you know, they make it sound like it's this warm, fluffy, healthy kind of lifestyle. But the reality of it is, you're up at 4:30 every morning to start your sessions at 5 a.m. You'll work through till 10 or 11 a.m. You'll have 3-4 hours off in the middle of the day, and then you go at it again in the arvo from 4 or 5 in the arvo till 7 or 8 o'clock, maybe even 9 o'clock at night. Then you do paperwork, go home, have a shower.
And you've got to work out in that time too, right? Because you've got to keep up the facade but you've got to look the part too, right? Like, there's, so you spend a couple of hours working out on top of that. You must be bloody exhausted.
You're exhausted, and you're doing it 5-6 days a week. So on top of that, you're doing it with these feelings. You can just feel these heavy, dark feelings inside you. And I was going to see counselors and psychologists about it and talk about this stuff. And what I noticed is it wasn't changing the feelings. Like, I was becoming more aware of why they were there. I was learning more about myself, but it wasn't moving the feelings. They were still there. I didn't feel any better. So I knew I had to feel better. So one thing led to another, and I'm next thing I know, I'm in the party world. So I remember going to King's Cross with a couple of friends one night, and you know, we had some drugs, and I'm walking down the back streets of King's Cross, and I just hear the music and see the party, and I'm just remember lighting up inside and just thinking, wow, I've found this whole new world that's been hidden from me for all these years, and you know, I just thought I'm going to tuck into this. And yeah.
Yeah, because when you have had depression, and you have, for me, depression has really been a suppression of emotions, right? And yeah. And so then when you get given something like ecstasy or speed, and you have this these feelings that yes. you haven't really been able to access, it's like,
yes.
whoa, this is amazing. It's very easy to have too much fun.
Yes, it's not just amazing. These are the feelings that I've been searching for my whole life, and now I've found them, and they're easy and accessible, and I can have them every weekend. Yes, please, where do I sign up? So this went on for a few months, probably about 1.5 years, I'd say, where I was working the massive weeks like I just described, and then on the weekends I'd party from Friday night till Monday morning. And you can do it for a while, but then after a while it starts to catch up with you. You're coming down off the drugs Monday, Tuesday, so you're not giving quality energy to your clients when you're working with them. So the business started to suffer, less money's coming in, less clients coming in, current clients are starting to become unhappy. So I was just digging myself deeper and deeper into this hole. And when it didn't match the reality in my head that I thought I'd have at that point in my life, you know, I started to become quite frustrated as well. So what happened was when I was in the party scene, it obviously quickly leads to the drug world. And there was a particular person that was up to no good. And I knew they were up to good, no good, but they didn't have a license. So they needed someone to drive them around and turn a blind eye. And I said, well, as long as I can turn a blind eye and I'm not going to get in trouble for it, then, you know, I'll do it. And then this person was going to, you know, pay me to drive them, plus they're also going to pay a manager to run my gym for me. So I found my ticket out. I found my ticket out of this hole that I'd dug, and it seemed like a great opportunity because I was going to make all this money. I'd be able to pay all my debts off and then, you know, start to save and then take the next step. So, yeah, that didn't really go to plan. What ended up happening is that I ended up connecting myself with a narcissistic psychopath who was a drug addict that just completely bamboozled me. So I got lured in with the carrots, you know, the drugs and the money and the partying and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of person, they make you feel sorry for them. They make you feel like they've got no friends or no family. And because I've got a big heart, you know, I wanted to make them feel, you know, accepted and have a friend and all that kind of stuff. And you know, plus they had all the things that I wanted as well, so that didn't help the cause. And then I just got deeper and deeper. So I've jumped out of one problem and gone deeper into another problem, because what they do is they lure you in with all the things you want, then they slowly cut you off from all the things that give you power. So, you know, I had to move into Northwest Sydney to live with this person. I didn't get to go back and visit my family, didn't get to go and see my friends. I was driving him around on drugs for most of the time, so we'd be up for days. I therefore wasn't going to the gym. I wasn't eating well. So physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, this person was just slowly breaking me down, slowly, slowly, slowly. And then, you know, they introduce you to a few people that, you know, if you do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing, then they're going to come after you. So I got to a point where I've had, you know, guns and knives pulled on me and told me that I can't leave the apartment where we're in. I can't go back to my family and friends, and that if I ever left, that they or the people they know of would come after my family and friends. So I was just terrified to leave. So I didn't want to stay, and I was too terrified to leave. So I was the epitome of feeling trapped. And this person was so jovial on the outside. He could be so funny and so charismatic and all these great positive traits, but on behind the scenes when no one else was around was just a dark, aggressive, angry person that just caused so much harm to myself that I just was like, there was points where I was like, you know, I hope I die, or I hope I end up in jail because it's going to be a better option of where I am. It was just like, I couldn't believe that I'd found myself in a situation that you see on the TV and movies. I thought it was all make-believe. I didn't think people like that truly existed. Fate would have it that one of his business partners wanted to do a split from him and move down to Melbourne. I ended up driving him around for a bit too while he was in Sydney, and we built up a bit of a relationship, and he told me he was leaving, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to put myself out a bit here and just Because if I mention to him that I want to come with him and then he tells the other guy, then I'm potentially putting my life at risk. But if he says yes and I can go with him, then I'm safe. So there was just something inside me that knew that that was just to say something and just word it the right way so it couldn't come back on me. And he said to me, yeah, mate, there's no way I'm going to leave you here with this guy because it's only going to get worse for you. If you stay, you're going to have to come. So he helped me come up with a plan where I'd escape. I had to escape in the middle of the night from the place where I was staying at in the city with fake IDs and go and collect money off a person and print out a fake boarding pass and fly down to Melbourne to meet this other guy. I'd never been to Melbourne in my life, so I've got to try and find my way from Melbourne airport to where he was staying in just the outer suburbs with literally the clothes on my back. I had no money. I had whatever credit was left on my phone and I just had to make it there. And luckily I did. Like fate would just have it that all the things worked out and I ended up escaping. If the person had found me escaping, I was gone. So that was just absolutely terrifying, you know, having to get out of that place and then down in Melbourne. And then I remember seeing him when I met him in the outer suburbs of Melbourne and he was there waiting with a friend at the front of a cafe and I got out the cab and I remember seeing him and just giving him a big hug and just saying, thank you. You know, I just feel like you've saved my life. I owe you everything, you know. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. So fate would have it that this person's also up to no good, but this guy was nice about it. So he never raised his voice. He never got aggressive. He never got angry. His dad and his uncle were both millionaires. So I knew he had it in his blood to make money. Plus he never touched drugs and he liked all the things I did. He liked girls. He liked going to the gym. He liked dressing nice. He liked eating at nice places, all these lavish things that I didn't really grow up with that I wanted to have when I was older. We enjoyed all the same things. So in an otherwise dark world, I'd think I'd found the right partner in crime, so to speak, for that particular time. And I was down there for about a year and a half. And again, my role was to drive him around. He didn't have a license either. And I said, my role is I'll help wherever I can as long as I'm not doing any hands-on things. So I can't directly be caught with things that I'm not meant to be doing. So again, I was no angel in that situation. I was definitely up to no good. But me, in my mind, trying to outsmart the system and find loopholes and grey areas so I could do it without getting into trouble. And yeah, we built up quite a relationship in that time. And I learned a lot of things about myself, like through business from this guy, even though I was in a world that we shouldn't have been doing, I still learned a lot from him. But it got to a point at about the 1.5-2 year mark where, so one of the rules was all the people in his little crew that he had was no one was allowed to have a girlfriend because he said, if a girl's got involved, they could tell someone something that they're not meant to know or they could help, they could throw us mentally or emotionally off our game or whatever we're meant to be concentrating on. So that was fine for me. I didn't get involved with any girls while I was down there, but he ended up doing it at the 1.5 year mark. And when he started doing that, I noticed that he started making a lot of little mistakes, right? Mistakes that he shouldn't be making because the mistakes are either going to get us hurt or locked up in jail. And I thought, if I'm noticing him making these mistakes, we're in big trouble because I'm not from that world. I'm only learned what I've learned in the last year and a half, so I'm only fresh to it. So I ended up sitting down having a conversation with him going, listen, I feel like I've repaid my debt. I've done a lot for you in the last 1.5-2 years. You know, what are your plans? What's your goals for all this? And he said to me, he goes, I wanted to be an international drug kingpin. And I said, well, you know, that's definitely not what I want to do. You know, my goal with this was to, like, get myself a business and a house and a car and, you know, get myself on top and then go from there. If that's what you're doing, like, you know, I want out. So the plan was to move overseas to the Philippines where I had another mate. So during that last half of the Melbourne phase, I was also living with another mate up in Newcastle, and his family business, they've got all the international licenses for all the bikini pageants in Australia. So I found like this next dream job where I'm judging bikini comps 3-4 nights a week, getting paid fuck all, but living an incredible lifestyle. And he had some opportunities to work on some international projects in the Philippines. So I really wanted to get over there and work with him on these projects because I was learning about sales and marketing and all these kind of things. And it was just a more legitimate and healthier lifestyle. So I was already heading over there anyway. Just before I was going to head over, one of the drug labs down in Melbourne got found. So the police and the real estate agents turned up and found a whole drug lab set up, and we didn't know if I was going to get tied into it or not because I wasn't in there doing any of that stuff, but I was around the fringes, like there was a chance that I was going to get tied into it. So he goes, look, it's best if you just leave the country. So I was going to go anyway. So he gave me a little bit of money and said, all right, his plan was to move over into the Philippines once he had everything set up in Australia. So, yeah, once everything was set up in Australia, he'd then start bringing all the money and all the stuff over to the Philippines and setting a life up for himself there because he was on the run in Australia. So I go, okay, well, I'll go over there and you know, start getting it set up. And plus I'd done a year and a half, 2 years of work, so I needed to be paid for the work that I'd been done. I hadn't been paid yet. You know, I'd been paid for living expenses while I was living in that world, but no cash, no money for all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I went over to the Philippines. While I was down in Melbourne working with this guy, while he was making the drugs, I was taking the drugs. So I was on ice and speed and stuff for about 1.5, 2 years for most days of the week. So when I went to the Philippines, I was obviously none of that, but when I got there was a whole bunch of cocaine over there and a massive party scene. So I've gone, again, from one problem into an even bigger problem. It was all fun and games for about 6 months, and there was one morning where we're up partying, and I had a little bit too much drugs one night where everyone else had gone to bed and I just kept going by myself, and all the food and alcohol's out of my system. So I had it, and when the drugs went in, it just kicked in harder than it was meant to, and I thought I'd OD'd, and my brother and his girlfriend had just arrived to come and visit me just to see how I was going and stuff, and they'd literally been there a night, and I've gone in their room the next morning, I'm like, fuck, mate, I think you have to call me an ambulance. I think I've just OD'd. Like, I feel like I'm going to die. My heart was beating out of my chest. Everything went blurry, and I just fucking panicked. And it was probably the most scared that I've ever been. And, you know, big guy in the Philippines, it's hard for him to get the stretchers into these things. And I'm literally lying flat out on the ground. I couldn't even stand up. And they got two little Filipino ambulance officers trying to lift me onto the bed to wheel me out. And my brother and his girlfriend are in hysterics. And it was just a fucking awful experience. And they took me to hospital, and they're asking me, have I taken anything? Have you done anything? And it's a third world country. You can't tell them what you've done over there because I don't know, is it the death penalty over there for drugs, or you're going to get other people in trouble? So I just kind of had to keep my mouth closed and just go, oh, I've drunk too much over here, and that's what it is. And, you know, I think the doctors clued on, thank God, because they ended up giving me a saline solution and some intravenous water and something and some Valium to help calm the system down. And so after that, that was when my anxiety started, like proper anxiety and panic attack, because I didn't know that emotion existed. So once I'd experienced the panic attack, I'm then living in fear of another panic attack. So for the next 3 to 4 months, I couldn't leave the apartment. I think it's called agoraphobia, where you're literally housebound by anxiety, and everything was setting me off. And it was just a really, really sad like moment in time for me, because I'd have these times where I'd wake up so anxious, like my hands were trembling and my body was shaking as soon as I wake up, that I had to drink alcohol to calm myself down because I didn't have enough money for medications or to go and see doctors. So alcohol was the only thing. And remember, there were some days I'd have 10 beer cans next to me, and I'd basically skull all 10 of them as soon as I wake up just to get back to level. And I thought, what have I fucking become? What have I done to myself? I'm a mess. Like, look at my life. How have I ended up in this position here? And I could easily see how people become alcoholics, because I'd come one myself. I didn't do it for the enjoyment of drinking. I wasn't doing it to get pissed and have a laugh and have a great time. I was doing it just to feel normal. So, yeah, that was a really sad low point for me. And then obviously my brother went home. He told mum, and mum found out about it, and then she wanted to come over and see me. And she come over to visit me, and it was just really sad for her to have to see her son like that. And there was one time where all she wanted to do when she came over, there's a big shopping center over there, like a big market thing over there, and that's all she wanted to do. And we waited till the last day to go there. And on the way there, I had a panic attack in the taxi, and we had to pull over into a cafe, and I'm literally shaking and scaring all the people in the shop. And I'm like, Mum, find me alcohol. And there was no alcohol shops around. So she's trying to get me water and juice, and then she's starting to run out of the Filipino peso over there to buy. And then I'm like, oh, what are we going to do? And I didn't want her to take her to the hospital. I didn't want her to see me even worse. And somehow we managed to get a taxi back home and, again, get more alcohol into me. I used to drink like red wine and bananas to help level me. It was really strange, but it was the only thing that worked. And she goes, this is enough, mate. Like, this is enough's enough. You've got to come home. And I just said to her, I go, look, I don't know if I can come home because there's a whole lot of trouble that's happened down in Melbourne, and I don't know if I'm going to be tied into it. And if I do, I could be looking at a really long jail sentence. So I've kind of got to stay here. And she just was like, nah, you can't stay. You're killing yourself here. And, you know, her and my family are having to send me over little bits of money each week to buy phone credit and 2-minute noodles and eggs to eat on a daily basis. I thought, I can't survive like this. I'm better off going back to Australia and going to jail. And at least there I've got medication, I've got doctors that will look after me and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I ended up flying home and had panic attacks on the plane, which was so scary. I can see how people would want to jump off a plane midair, because when you're having the panic attack and the flight stewardesses wouldn't give me any more drinks, they cut me off, and I'm trying to explain to them, listen, this is the only thing that calms me down. If you just give me some, I'll be able to calm. And they're like, no, sir, you've had enough. And I'm like, oh. So it was I think we were 90 minutes out from Sydney, and the panic was just kicking in so hard. I remember just crying to myself thinking, fuck, if I survive this next 90 minutes, you know, I might be able to live. But I couldn't see myself making it through, and somehow did. It's, the story doesn't do it justice how intense the emotions were. And landed at Sydney Airport, and then we get there, and then customs grabbed me because they said I looked suspicious looking through the airport. I'm like, yeah, because I'm having a fucking panic attack. And I said, told them that, and they're like, no, nah, mate, we need to search your bags. And so they've searched my bags and my credit cards and all that kind of stuff. And they go, oh, we found traces of drugs. Have you got any drugs on you? And I'm like, no, I don't. And I'm like, but the people that I was with, they were probably partying, and there's stuff all over my clothes from it. So anyway, they're just doing their job, and they've got to search me and all my stuff. I'm having a panic attack meanwhile. So it was just the most intense situation where you're getting interrogated, and they're kind of playing on that because they know you're panicky and you're more likely to kind of spill the beans or, you know, tell them you've been up to no good. But again, you've just got to sit your way through it and get released out into it. And they finally let me out after about an hour, and I've got my mum and my dad and my pop and my brother and his girlfriend all waiting for me, and I just walk out looking like a fucking mess. And again, they've got to get red wine to calm me down, and they're like, mate, you got to get your life sorted, you got to get back on track. And so I started going to like relapse prevention groups and psychologists, counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, the works to try and fix the problem. And you know, I'd go and talk to them, and I just realized more and more things that I already knew, but none of it was working. And I just become so frustrated. I'm like, none of this stuff is working. And I just couldn't make it work. And I'm like, all right, but I've got to start to get my life back on track. So there was a smaller matter that I got charged for before I went to the Philippines when I was down in Melbourne. There was a small matter that I got charged, and I was meant to go to court over, and I obviously missed the court date because I was in the Philippines. So I rang the solicitor. I said, listen, I've got this small matter that I need to go and hand myself in over. Do you think it's a good idea that I do that? And I'm pretty much saying, if I do that, am I going to get in more trouble? And she goes, oh, let me make a few phone calls, I'll find out for you. And so she made a few phone calls, and she got back to me. She goes, no, look, it's all clear. Come down, hand yourself in, it'll be fine. Well, they'll reset their court date for you. And I go, good. I want to get that out of the way, because then I can start. I don't want to have to be living in Sydney and waiting for a knock on my door one day and going, listen, we're going to take you down to Melbourne for these other charges. So flew down there with mum, felt really uncomfortable the whole time. Like, my clothes were too small for me. I was busting out of my shirt and my pants. I just put on so much weight, felt so disgusting and all these types of things. And we're flying down there. And anyway, we go to the police station to hand myself in, and no one's there in the front desk room. And then mum starts joking around me going, oh, yeah, there's no one here. Yeah, they're all going to come out and get you, Scott. They're like, oh, we're going to arrest you. I'm like, oh, yeah. And anyway, one guy comes around at the counter and goes, oh, Mr. Franklin, yeah, good. We've been waiting for you. Come on through. So I go through that door, through another door, into this back room, and then they close the door. And as I go in, there's about five or six police and detectives in there waiting for me. So it was a setup. So I got in there, and I remember everything going really slow, super slow, and I was just like, oh, fuck, here we go. It's all kind of come to a head right now. There's no escaping it. This is it. And they're like, we've been waiting for you. We know that you're involved with this, this, and this. And they just – then, and these, the detectives in there, like, you know how they're going to operate. They lie to you, and they try and trick you into words, and they just try and get you to talk, to admit to things and all sorts of stuff. And it was just, I knew what they were up to, but I just knew, just no comment the whole way through, no comment, no comment. And then, you know, hopefully you get your best case scenario. So I did that. And then they go, oh, well, if you're not going to talk to us, then you're just going to make the matters worse for you. Plus, we heard that the rest of your crew were going to – and they're making these little stabbing, poking things. They go, oh, we heard that your crew, they're waiting for you inside because they reckon it's your fault that everyone got caught. And I'm thinking, fuck, mate, you got no idea what's going on. You know, now you're here. You're meant to be on the police side, and you're trying to intimidate me into talking. Like, anyway, it was just a real eye-opener to see how they operate. The worst part after that was walking out of that little back room in handcuffs in front of mum, and just seeing her break down into tears and just singing, fuck, you know, what a loser I'd become. And all in that moment, it was just, yeah, another just really shit moment. And then they take you to like the courts, and underneath the courts are where the holding cells are. Now, the Melbourne justice system is so backlogged with stuff that I was in underneath the courts for 2 weeks straight, 2 weeks without sunlight. And in there, they treat you like fucking animals. Like they give you frozen meals that sometimes not cooked all the way through. Sometimes it's out of date. You've got, and I'm not a judgmental person, but you've got all kinds of people that they bring in off the streets and all sorts of things, and they just chuck you all into these underground cells and just hold you there until your court case gets heard. And so you sit in there, and then they finally process you into the normal part of the jail. And while I was waiting in the holding cells down the bottom, it was probably the lowest moment of my life. I still remember it clearly. When you go in and talk to your family, they put you in these little booths, and in the booth, in the middle of it's this little glass window, so you can't,
like in the
you
movies. Can't get through,
exactly like the movies. I remember going in there, and you know, obviously during my party years and all that kind of stuff, while I was doing that, my brother was working hard. He was working in the mines and becoming an electrician and just, you know, just working his guts out to kind of make something for himself. And I remember just sitting there thinking, fuck, I don't deserve to have this good family. I don't deserve it. Like, look what I've put them through, and they're still flying down from Sydney to come and see me here. And I remember just breaking down, and my brother said to me, he goes, mate, don't worry, we're gonna get you out of here. I'm going to get you, you know, a solicitor. Because at that point I was like, I had no money, so I thought I'm going to have to get legal aid. And I had heavy charges laid on me, and I thought, this is not the situation where you want to have to be relying on legal aid, you know, to try and get you out of there. So when he said that, I just thought, fuck, what an incredible human being my brother was in that moment, you know, to cut, and because I bullied him when he was younger and all sorts of things, and I just thought, fuck, for him to come through at that moment just showed me that how good human beings can actually be. And that, and it broke me. It literally broke me. And I just thought, fuck, I don't want to have to put them through this. I don't want to have to go through this again in my life. So I'm gonna turn my life around. So when they take you to jail, when I got there, I remember it was just very somber to see these big units, and everyone's walking around in green clothes and white Dunlop Follies, and it was just a very depressing vibe. And it's not like the movies. It's very quiet, too quiet. And I got there and I thought, fuck, I'm not going to be able to survive in here. I'm going to have to relabel this place. So at that moment, I relabeled it from jail to a personal development center. And everyone in there was there to teach me something about myself, because at that point, I was a lost soul. I didn't know who I was, what I wanted to be. I didn't know anything anymore. I wanted to sort of hang around a few of the older heads in there, because I knew they weren't going to try and be heroes, and they were just in there wanting to get their time done, and that kind of made the first part easy. And I still didn't know how long I was looking at, so I got involved with some education while I was in there, and there was a lady in there teaching a small business course. But this lady was one special lady, because she'd worked in politics, she'd worked in the corporate world, she built schools in Nepal, she'd done all kinds of personal development work you can think of, right? And she chose to work in a male prison to teach personal development and spirituality and how the human mind works to anyone who would listen. So I thought to myself, well, clearly I don't know how my mind works, because look where I've ended up. So if you can teach me something I don't know, I'm all ears. And it was one of the first times in my life where I sat there and I didn't object once. I just sat there and I listened. Even if in my head I was disagreeing, I listened. And I listened and I listened to everything that she was talking about. And she taught me all these concepts that I still use today. She taught me about the ego, you know, that voice in your head that always wants more. And because it always wants more, it can never be satisfied. And I go, well, that explains my depression, my low self-esteem, my anxiety. When I can't get what I want, it gives me these negative feelings. I go, okay, but it also means that everyone has it. And at that moment, I realized everyone has it. I go, okay, number one, I'm not alone. But number two, I know some fucking great actors, because I thought I was the only one who had it. No one else was letting on that they experienced it to that extent.
Yeah.
And then she told me how all these negative feelings combine in our body to create a pain body. And she would just talk more about these types of things. And I said to her, I was starting to join the dots up as she was talking. And I said to her, listen, I went to see this holistic doctor years ago for my depression. And he had this technique that would release my depression. And I said, I think I can remember it. Should I try it again? And she goes, yeah, give it a try. I took myself through the process, and it released an emotion out of my body. And she goes, do you think it will work for me? I said, well, let's give it a try. So again, she's done a lot of personal development work. She was no stranger to this type of stuff. The emotion that I took her through, she had it for about 40 or 50 years. So I took her through the steps, and then bang, it released at the end. And I remember her face, her whole physiology changed, and she lit up inside. And she looked at me, she looked at me and she goes, Scotty, this is a game changer. what you've just done then is going to change the whole world. She goes, I've been waiting in here 4 years for you. I go, what do you mean? You didn't even know me 4 years ago. She goes, no, I knew that I needed to come to prison to teach somebody who will then go out and teach the world. She goes, and now that's you, and I'm certain of it. And then she goes, you know what you've got to do now, don't you? And I said, yes. So I spent the next nine months of my sentence just releasing every single negative emotion that was trapped inside my body. And whenever every negative experience has a negative emotion that attaches to it. And when you release that emotion, the memory can then be stored and you then become at peace. And I remember I just did so much releasing work. I didn't know where it was going to end up because I had no one teaching it to me. I was just making it up as I was going along. But I got to this point, this monumental point where I was lying on my bed one day in my all greens and my white Dunlop Volleys, and I'm staring up at the ceiling, and I just had this moment where I realized, I'm like, far out. I'm actually happy, relaxed, and confident, and I've got nothing. I'm in jail. How is this even possible? This means I've been striving for all the wrong things for my life. The answers were all inside me the whole time. I just needed to find these things that would help me connect to these things inside myself where all the treasure was. And, it was just such a special moment because I'd found my confidence. It was like the whole reason I went into the drug world, despite the money and the lifestyle I wanted, was to find confidence. I'd always align myself with confident people to try and figure out how to do it. And then when I'd found a technique that would release all the negative things out of my body, I found that confidence was a natural state. I didn't have to do anything. It was just sitting there. It just, when it wasn't blocked up by all these other things, it was just there. So that was like the first part of it. And then we obviously combined that with the small business course and, you know, started to develop into a little business model. And then, you know, a few changes happened when I was in jail, the court case happened. And part of releasing all these other things, the other thing I found is that we all have an authentic self inside of us. So it's like your gut instincts, it's like your heart, and you communicate with it. And the moment that I found out that we've got it and that it's never wrong, I thought, well, I'm just going to ask it every single question and never be wrong ever again. And, a combination of that and just a lot of releasing work had come to the court time. And I remember I'd just been sitting quiet the whole time and I was having a conversation with my authentic self, my higher self. And the conversation was along the lines of, well, who are you going to be loyal to? You're going to be loyal to this guy who's taken you into the drug world, who hasn't paid you and who hasn't looked after your family like he said he would if you're in jail and all these types of things. You're going to be loyal to him, or are you going to be loyal to your family who are paying for your solicitors and who are coming to visit you and write letters and all this kind of stuff? And at that point, it was a no-brainer. So,
isn't it funny? Because it's like one decision is based from fear, right? And the other was based in love. But so often it's the fear that drives us because it's like, you know, I mean – In some ways, the guy was like almost a savior because he took you out of a really shitty situation and got you into something better, which ended up just being as bad. But then there's also this debt that happens, right? Like we feel indebted to that person even when they have wronged us because they at some point they saved us, you know?
That's right. Yeah, and the thing is they don't fully – you're not fully manipulated into the situation. Like there's a big part of you that knowingly goes into that situation and you know what kind of trouble could come from it. So they're not completely to blame at all. It's interesting how it all plays out because you never imagined it playing out that way. And then when it gets to that turning point where it's just like, well, what made you change your mind? And you go, well, it was actually my authentic self or my higher self asked me a really powerful question. And I realized that my family is more important to me than the drug world. So at that point, I called my solicitor and I said, look, I need you guys to come in. I need to have a chat with you guys. And they go, have you changed your mind? I said, yeah, I have. So they come in and the moment you say that you're going to testify, they've got to take you out of mainstream prison because you'll be killed in mainstream prison for testifying. It's the biggest sin that you can commit in that world. So to me, it was a very defining moment. It's like I've cut off from that world completely. There was no going back. Yeah, so they moved me into a separate part of the jail, which they call the spine. So the spine is where all the isolated people are. So there's all the worst of the worst are in there, and they chuck you in there with them until they figure out where they're going to put you because they've essentially got to hide you in a certain part of the jail. And you know, when I was in there, I thought I'd be in there for a few days until they found like a protection prison that they put you in, where people that testify where they go. And anyway, I was in there for 9 weeks. Wow. So during this, I was not expecting that. So during each day, you're in a 23-hour lockdown. So you're in a cell for 23 hours You can go out for a run out for 1 hour, but if you choose to go in the run out, you're in a concrete cell, which is about 3 meters by 4 meters. It's freezing cold. There's a radio playing very faintly and a toilet in the corner and a bubbler. That's it. So I'm like, why would I go out there for that? Exactly.
Insane.
Right.
Insane. So yeah. I can't even comprehend what that must be like. But the one thing that just popped into my head was, I guess in that moment, you really have two choices. One is like full victim mode where you totally, I guess, lose your sanity. And the other is to be friends with yourself.
Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what happened with me. So that small business teacher, she told me about a thing called a Vipassana. Is a silent retreat that you go on for I think it's like 10 days or something, where you're basically silent the whole time, and it's very cleansing because all sorts of things pop up for you that you got to face and deal with. And it was funny how I was almost put into a situation, not just for 10 days, but for 9 weeks. You know, it was like a 9-week Vipassana because I didn't go on the run out. So I went on 2 or 3 and I thought, well, this is worse. I'd rather be in my cell. And the people in there, like in that little spine section that they've got you in, they talk to each other like animals, like they're threatening to kill each other and each other's families and calling each other dogs and rats and all these types of things. And I'm just like, holy fuck, like where am I? I've found hell on earth. It's right here. So I basically just went internal. I just went in and I just went deeper and deeper with all my releasing work. And I ended up writing a letter to my best mate explaining to him what had happened in the last 7 years. I ended up, part of my court case is you've got to write for your solicitor parts of your life story and what happened. And I did it like each day at the same time, and I'd write. And when I was writing, I noticed that it wasn't me writing. Like I wasn't conscious while I was writing. My hand was just, you know, flying through the pages. And I got to the end of it and I'm like, wow, there's something in this. I showed it to a few people and they're like, this is basically a book. So I've gone, oh, okay. And then I literally only found it probably 3 months ago. I was flicking through my cupboards and I've found the book in there, and I'm like, this is a book here. I've got to get this book published because it's going through a lot of the stories that we're talking about now. So, you know, during this 9-week Vipassana stage, you know, I wrote letters. I wrote letters to people that I bullied when I was younger. So I wrote letters to like some childhood friends and people that I knew, just apologizing and explaining my situation. I wrote more letters to like family members and other things, just, you know, apologizing and saying sorry and all that kind of stuff. So it was really deep reflective stuff. And yeah, basically at the end of that point, they ended up moving me to a protection part in a jail. And that was like the next part of the journey, because when I got there, it was two of the best teachers I could have ever asked for, and it was like chalk and cheese of how we all come together. So the first guy, he's got other brothers, and they'd all been Australian champions or Golden Gloves boxers. And when I got there, I said to him, I go, look, I've come in here a little boy and I want to leave a man. I've come in here because I don't know how to stand up for myself. Can you help me? And he's like, well, mate, first of all, you've got a lot of balls coming in here admitting that, because you could really be – people could take advantage of that. But because you've shown a lot of front, he goes, I'm going to tuck you under my wing and I'm going to help you. He goes, I'm going to teach you it through boxing, not as an aggression style, but more as an art. So this guy was literally like Mr. Miyagi and Danielson. He was teaching me boxing as an art form. And he had me filling out this little book every day, drawing diagrams and writing out things I needed to work on. And I'm doing shadowing, practicing the mirror, and, you know, changing my diet completely. And yeah, just completely just reversing everything. And he asked me, he said, what do you want to do when you get out? And I said, look, I really want to do like health seminars and things like that. And he goes, I'm going to tell you something I haven't told anyone about 25 years. I used to do seminars in prison and outside for families. And he went and got these old newspaper articles, and it was him doing it. And he goes, a guy by the name of Lou Tice was a presenter, public speaker in America. He goes, this guy flew from America to go and find this guy in H Division back in the 70s and taught this guy this program, Investments in Excellence. And he goes, I'm now going to pass it on down to you. I'm going to teach you the whole lot. So go and get a table and a chair and get ready to learn. So I've gone around and I've got a table and a chair and I've set it up in the hallway of the prison, and he's up there in front of the whiteboard and teaching it to me, and everyone's walking past shaking their heads like, what the fuck are you two doing? And I'm just taking these mad notes, you know, writing it all down. And he just taught me so much things, and it's all a lot of the stuff I'm incorporating now in the 7 domains of life. it just goes deep into like values and role models and affirmations and, you know, creating and manifesting and goals and all these things that powerfully tie in together. And when you learn it in an environment like that where you've got nothing else to think about, I learned it to such a depth. I've got piles and piles of books of filled out of all my own journey working through all that stuff.
Yeah, it's that right. It's just like the most, like, your story is just incredible. But I was just thinking, like, in any other situation, we do have that freedom, but in that prison, you were given an incredible amount of freedom, right? Because it's like,
Yes. You
weren't bound by what we have on the outside. Like, the outside can be more of a prison, right? Because we have to live up to society's expectations and what, you know, ideas of external ideas of success. So we're trying to live up to these ideas, and that is like becomes like our prison. But for you, you were in the prison without having the constraints of living up to other people's expectations, being something other than you are to fit in. You were just there. That's an incredible gift.
Yeah. So exactly how you just said it, like that exact palm card of what you just said then, someone said that to me while I was in there. I think it was the first teacher. And she said to me, the reason that you've got yourself in jail is because you're in jail mentally and emotionally long before you're in a physical jail. She goes, if you want to get out of jail, then you have to be able to get out of jail mentally and emotionally before you'll physically be released. She said, the second part is what you just said then. You've got life, or the universe has given you a moment in time where you have space. And you've got time. You're not going to get this again, because fingers crossed you ain't coming back here. So you need to make the most of this time. So that's the thing, is when you go into jail, you can make whatever you want from it. You could become the best criminal in the world, or you could become, you know, just completely transform yourself. But you've got to be mindful and know what to look out for. And to me, to find these teachers in jail of all places was just absolutely incredible. Like, the last place I would have thought ever to look. And the insights and things they taught me, it made me use that time so wisely, because I knew why I was there and what I was doing.
When the student is ready.
Oh, it's so true. You know, you hear these things when you're young, but when it happens and you're in the moment and you're like, oh, God, this is the teachers and I'm the students and it's all happening, it lights you up inside, and it brings your vibration and your energy up to this higher level where you can just retain huge amounts of information. You learn concepts that you couldn't previously get your head around or be able to implement, and things just slowly start to mentally and emotionally fall into place, and then physically fall into place. So, yeah, it was magical to get them. And then the final teacher that I had in there, I call this guy the Beautiful Mind. And the reason I call him the Beautiful Mind, because he was labeled as bipolar, schizophrenic, sociopathic, everything, right? This guy was in the too hard basket. And I'd noticed that when he was in there, he had these rageful emotional reactions to things. And when he was in there, he was also trying to lose weight. Two things I happen to be good at. So I said to him, I go, mate, I'm not being disrespectful, but I said, but, you know, we don't really have much to do in here. So if you want some help with controlling these emotions and the weight loss, I go, mate, my background's in exercise science. Like, I can help you with that. I know how to do that. And I said, with the emotion things, I've got a technique that can help you manage and control all that. And I remember he looked me right in the eye and he said to me, he goes, if you fuck with my head and fuck me up, bad things are going to happen to you. Are you sure you can help me? To my authentic self, are you sure you can do this? And the little voice inside me goes, yes. And I remember looking at him straight in the eye and I go, yes, I can. And he goes, all right. And then he looked away off to the side. And I thought, fuck, this is one of them moments where I've kind of just, I broke him. Not, I didn't break him in that moment, but I stood up for myself. It was the first time that I'd been intimidated and stood over most of my life. And to have someone of that kind of caliber, because he was in there for really bad things too, for me to be able to like mentally and emotionally stand up to him in that moment was like, I broke free of something in that moment. It was like chalk and cheese, because we were from different worlds. He could see things that other people can't see. I'll give you an example, right? He said to me, because I wanted to know how he saw the world and how he thought. And he goes, okay, I want you to watch the officer walk from one end of the hall to the other. And when they get back, I want you to tell me what kind of car they drive, what kind of wife they have, and how many kids they have. How the fuck am I going to figure this out? So I did it. And he goes, what's your answer? So I just made up something where I was just guessing. And he told me what his answer was. And he goes, let's go up and find out. So we go up to the officer and he goes, excuse me, sir, what kind of car do you have? And this guy in the jail, he predicted two cars. And he predicted the color of the car. He predicted the personality of his wife, how many kids. And I'm just blown away by this guy. And I'm like, how did you do that? He goes, how someone does everything is how they do everything. Mm. So this guy walked. He was very tall and practical. So he goes, well, what's a practical kind of car? You know, Ford or a Holden? You know, look how his hair. His hair is very conservative. So it's going to have a conservative color. So it's either going to be white or gray. He doesn't look like a white guy. He's more of the gray. Like, look what he's doing. He's talking to criminals. Like, he's in the gray area. So he broke it down. And I was just blown away by the intelligence of this guy. And he took me into his cell and everything was like military precision. Like, it was like OTT, how well everything was well placed and all this kind of stuff. And he goes, do you know why I do this, Scott? Like, I've got no fucking idea. Why do you do it? He goes, because I'm confident and I'm organized. And I go, okay. And he goes, I'll show you. He goes, grab the newspaper, pick any page in the newspaper and I'll read to you what's on that page. So I'd flick through and I go, all right, that page. And then we'd close it back up and he goes, all right, what it's about. And he goes, blah, 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 blah. And he exactly described what was on that page. And I said, how do you do that? He goes, because I'm organized. You know, everything I do is organized. When your life is organized, information just goes straight into the shelf in your minds where they need to go. And then when you're retrieving information from your subconscious up, it just grabs a little bit of that, little bit of that, little bit of that, and then comes up with this answer that you wouldn't otherwise know. So he goes, let's just be clear on one thing. I'm only teaching this thing, all this stuff to you because you're not in the same world as me. Because if I was teaching you this stuff and you were still in the same world as me, we'd be enemies and that would be dangerous. He goes, but because you're not coming back to this world, he goes, you're just here for a holiday. You're just here to learn and then you'll be out of here. So I'm going to teach you everything because we've got nothing else in here to do. So, yeah, it was another special teacher that I had where he just taught me just – You can't find people that know these types of information. And he could just see, like, you just stare at the suns or at plants or at nature sometimes. And he goes, what am I doing? He goes, I'm energizing myself. All energy comes from the sun and all plants are connected. So
it's
so weird, right?
Like, there's that Jim Carrey video going around at the moment where he's at Fashion Week and he basically says, none of this matters. And the girl is kind of like, what? Anyway, he's talking about, you know, this is all just kind of an illusion. Yeah. And people are like, oh my God, Jim Carrey's gone crazy. And I'm like, no, he's so not crazy. He's about as lucid as anyone can be. And I think sometimes when we don't understand something from where we are, we put someone in a box with a bunch of labels that makes them different from us because we can't relate to that person, yeah. You know, and so, but that box creates a distance between them and us when the reality is we are all the same. There is no separation between us, you know, so it's interesting, right? Like you meeting this guy and having these conversations with a guy who was, I guess, psychologically a total mess.
Yeah.
But had such a level of clarity. So is he actually messed up or are we messed up?
Yes. And so because he was such a high energy individual, we would these releasing techniques that I use in my coaching stuff now, when we're talking to one another, right, if one person had a negative facial expression, if your voice tone went negative, if you had a negative feeling in your body, if you did anything negative, you had to release it. So this guy is pushing me to release emotions and things out of my body to, like, I felt like an SAS commando soldier, how hard he was pushing me because he couldn't let up because there's also some fear inside of me that didn't want to let him down but was also fearful of his reaction if I got it wrong. So it was just this magical dynamic where he was just release to this point where towards the end of my sentence, I was around this guy who in my previous life I would have been so terrified and shit scared of, and I felt like I was just at peace. You know, I was just so happy to be around him and his company that we would just had moments of laughter and pure joy. And we're in jail away from our family and friends. So that's where I learned a lot of the belief in the stuff that I do now. Like I felt like I've worked with the hardest of the hard people that you could imagine. Like I don't feel a harder test could be thrown my way. I feel like I've already handled that. So when I see people now, it's like, can you help me with this or with that? I'm like, yes. Like This guy was on every kind of medication you can think of. And he got to a point where he goes, he had the medications in his hand. He goes, see this, Scotty? He goes, I'm meant to be taking this, but I don't take it anymore. I only do it to keep them happy. But just so you know, I'm just really peaceful now. I don't even need to take it. And he was on antipsychotics, antidepressant, everything. He didn't need to take it because he'd linked that gap up between his spiritual intelligence, his intelligence, and his emotional intelligence. So he had that little triangle going on where he had it all figured out. So yeah, that's where a lot of the belief come from. And I guess that's what transitioned from that point there into the real world is, you know, putting it into practice, you know, because in jail, in essence, you don't really have a lot of distractions. And yeah, like coming out, there's a massive fear of judgment. Is the community going to shun me? Is my family and friends not going to talk to me anymore? Is it, you know, you just don't know how you're going to be perceived. And I thought, there's no point hiding anything from anyone because everything can be found out about me on the internet or whatever. So there's no point keeping any secrets. So I just become very vulnerable and very open. And, you know, I'm still to this day an open book. If anyone asks me questions, I'll give the answers for it. And I've basically had nothing but positive reactions from people. I feel that, you know, since coming out, I kind of represent to people that you can turn your life around, that it doesn't matter how low it gets. You know, if you meet the right people and have the right encounters and you learn the right things, like any person given the right resources can make anything for themselves in their lives. And I feel that.
And let's be real, you were in a physical prison, but we all have our own prisons.
Yeah.
You know, we're all living in some kind of prison of our existence. So so you're like, yours is very literal, but there's so many people out there living in, you know, more metaphorical kind of prisons.
Yeah, it's and I just think about that all the time, you know. It's just kind of like, it's humbling to remember, you know, what I've been through and why I do what I do, because at the end of the day, I could have been dead. You know, I could have been in jail for a lot longer. I could have been dead. So I feel like I've got a duty. Like my duty now is to do this stuff for a girl. I feel like life has chosen me to go out and deliver this message. That's now my job. And there's no say in the matter. It's just go out and do it, because otherwise I would have been killed or I would have been doing a longer jail sentence. So that's how I look at it. So it just fills me with like a massive rush of energy to know that I'm just so clear on it, because I spent so long of my life having no direction and feeling quite lost, to now having like absolute certainty and absolute passion and a motivation and an energy inside me that just keeps, you know, taking me along this incredible journey where I meet amazing people like yourself and, you know, a lot of people that I work with that come into my life, and they're all fragments of myself. Like every time I meet someone, they remind me of a former part of myself. So I feel that because I've been through that pain point and I've solved it on every level, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, that when I help people and I guide them towards the answers, I'm giving them my healed energy. You know, the energy inside my body is literally telling the energy in their body what it needs to do. And that's what creates that you know, it's like a magnet effect. I feel that humans don't really listen, but they'll copy. They'll copy what you're doing. And because I feel like I pride myself that I epitomize everything that I teach is stuff that I'm doing myself, like it's stuff that I'm implementing every single day of the week. And I feel that that's why the magnets inside my body are strong when I connect to another person, because I'm living it and breathing it every day and constantly coming up with new challenges and having to figure out how to overcome them. So it keeps me grounded. It keeps me humble. It doesn't allow me to go back into the ego world where I think that I'm better than anyone else or I know more, because I don't. I'm always finding new teachers and I'm always learning new things. But what I am good at is digesting it and then implementing it straight away. Like that's how I sort of keep myself on track with it. Plus I've got an awesome support network around me now, like my family, my partner, my close friends. Like a lot of my teachers and mentors are really close friends as well. So I just feel like I'm living in a completely different world now, and it's just I've got it set up so that I can only succeed. Like even when I start to sort of go the wrong way, there's too many people now looking out for me and keeping me true to myself that keeps me on track.
Yeah, and I mean you have lost everything. So I feel like sometimes when you have lost everything, there's like the fear isn't as great, right? Because it's like
There's no fear.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's the thing is when you're at the bottom, when you hit that rock bottom, you lose your attachment to everything. Like that's one of the good things about a rock bottom moment is you learn what it's like to not be attached to nothing, like not even family, not even yourself. You're completely detached. And then when you survive the rock bottom moment, you realize that you can get through life being attached to nothing. And then when you start to build yourself back up, you don't do it for other people. You do it solely on yourself. You work on yourself. And then, you know, most of my life I was so dependent on other people, you know, for advice or for answers and things like that. And when I found that I've got all my own advice and all my own directions built inside myself, you get to a point where I'm like, well, I actually don't need anyone else in my life now. The only reason I need someone is because I enjoy their company,
yeah,
or they, you know, they just give you the support or sometimes a backboard to throw your ideas at to either give you a yes or no.
Yeah, you know, I think so like when you're at when you reach that point, everything else is cream, right? Because yes. Like everything is a bonus. You're not attached yeah. to somebody needing to provide you with something.
That's right.
You know, you're kind of free of all that stuff. So all of the stuff after that point is all a bonus. So it becomes so much more enjoyable.
It's so much enjoyable. And I've been thinking about this a lot recently. There was an interview by Anthony Robbins and Gary Vee. And one of the questions I ask is, what are most successful people in life have in common? And they both said gratitude. And from that moment, I started really thinking about, I'm like, what is gratitude? And then I started going over and I'm like, okay, well, if I had have got the life I've got now straight off the bat, like say I just started doing this straight out of high school and all that kind of stuff, I wouldn't truly appreciate it for what it is because I wouldn't have the negative experiences to refer to. You know, I wouldn't have them rock bottom and sad moments to show me how good life can be, right? So because I've had them down moments, them low moments, it makes me truly appreciate and truly grateful for what I have now. I think as humans, we love to be right and we love to know why we're doing things. So if we know why we're doing something and we're getting it right, it literally adds that cream that you're talking about on top that makes us feel so good while we're doing things. And it could even be the simplest things. We know why we're doing it and I know it makes me feel good. And, you know, the gratitude as well that I've realized comes a lot from other people. Like I was in my former life quite selfish, you know, looking how to make myself feel good. But what I've realized is that when people that I love and care about feel good, the reflection effect back into my own body seems to light me up twice as much and it lasts for a lot longer. So it's not a spike. It's not a spike of pleasure that goes up and down. I think it's true happiness that kind of lasts for, you know, days, weeks or months even. So, yeah, the appreciation and the gratitude on top of it. And I never knew what it was, but now that I do, it just seems to make everything feel a lot better.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's on the couch. Biggest fear?
My biggest fear growing up was being bullied because I used to avoid it so much. I used to have so many friends and used to be such a people pleaser. But I think that on the fear side of a people pleaser is the fear of people not liking them. And the fear of people not liking is actually the bullying. And when you already don't have a high regard of yourself mentally and emotionally and spiritually, then when someone else does it to you, it kind of just amplifies that. So I think, yeah, a massive fear of bullying, fear of rejection would definitely be the biggest ones probably through most of my life. And then obviously just the fear of pain and the fear of dying, especially when I was in the drug world and jail, like this really having moments of, you know, where you think this could be it, I'm going to die a horrific death here and stuff like that. Probably transitioned into that. And now it's probably more just the fear of like the people that I love. If something happened to the people that I love, I feel that nothing can really hurt me. I'm solid how I am. But if something happened to people that I love and care about, then that would rock me pretty hard. That would probably be the main one at the moment, yeah.
Yeah, that's the same as me. So what do you struggle with now?
At the moment, probably struggle with more business side of things. So I guess that health-wise, it's always something that I've been passionate about and learned through most of my life. Friends-wise, like primary school, high school, footy and surfing and uni and partying, I've always had lots of friends. I feel that in the last 4 to 5 years, I've built up my sense of family. So right now the focus is business, and it's just little things like when a computer doesn't work, it just snaps me. You know, they're all my triggers at the moment. So just around technology and business, and you know, learning the world of marketing and sales, and learning how to connect with people through social media and all them kinds of things is where I'm probably challenged most at the moment. But with that sense, because I feel that I've got tools to get through it, it makes it a hell of a lot easier. If I didn't have that, then, you know, I can see why some people just don't get businesses off the ground, or they just get stuck in a rut.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, you know, we all have that little voice in our heads. I guess it's the ego telling us untruths about ourselves. Do you hear yours now?
Yeah, but I feel that I've synced it up. I feel that my ego and my authentic self now work together. So in the first part of my life, it was just the ego dominating, and that's why it was causing so much negativity, chaos and drama in my life. And then when I found the authentic self and found that it was never wrong, then I started to be guided by that. In the initial phases, I just completely neglect the ego, so I kind of just got rid of it altogether. But I've since learned that when they work together, it's even more powerful, because the way I look at it, the authentic self is like the big boss, and the ego is like the manager and the workers. Right. And sometimes the manager and the workers, they raise really good points. We shouldn't ignore everything that they say, because sometimes they're telling us things that we need to think about that we may have skimmed over the top of. So whenever I get a doubt or a concern or a worry, all I do now is I send that question down to my authentic self, and I say, listen, is this something that we need to worry about? And if it is, we'll then problem solve it. But if it's not, it's just my ego raising a concern, and then I'll just release it.
I love that.
The other analogy I've got for it, I think I like this one better than other. No one else has really clicked with this one, but I really love it. It's like the ego is like, you know, when you go 10-pin bowling and they put the bumpers in? So I feel like the ego is like the bumper in bumper bowling, because when you hit the ego, it's centering you. You know, when your ego feels depressed, it's reminding you to be happy. So again, it's centering you to go back to the middle. Or if you're feeling anxious, the negative emotions are telling you to do the opposite. You know, it's reminding you to be more calm and relaxed. So I feel that it centers you. So, yeah, look, I still have the same negative thoughts, same as everyone else. I just feel that my ways of managing it now is more in harmony with itself.
Yeah. Failure. What does failure mean to you? How does it look?
Failure to me is when I don't learn. So if I don't learn a lesson and I become stuck in a vicious cycle of the same lesson over and over again, then I know in that moment I'm failing. So I kind of pride myself on my ability to learn a lesson relatively quick these days, because I've had such a huge chunk of my life making mistakes over and over again. Yeah. So, and look, it still happens from time to time where I'm like, oh, fuck, here comes that pattern again. Here's this part where I keep stuffing up again. So I know, okay, you know, center myself, you know, learn the lesson, implement the lesson, get it right, and then do it a couple of times getting it right, and then I seem to be on top of it. But, yeah, that's probably the main failure now. Like I used to have a huge fear of failure and not being good enough, but they're just not part of my reality anymore. It's just, you know, I'm either getting it right or I'm learning these days.
Yeah, totally. Success. What does success look and feel like to you now?
Success is definitely emotion-based. So it's like if I'm – the way I look at it is there's certain people that make you happy and there's certain ones that don't. There's certain places that make you happy and certain places that don't. And there's certain situations and activities that make you happy and certain ones that don't. So to me, success is spending more time on that side than on that side. So I'm just getting more and more grounded in the kind of people that I spend my time with. Do I add value to their life or vice versa, and therefore are we making each other happy? And just the places and the activities doing, and even the thoughts that I entertain, it's just how does it make me feel? And I feel that everything kind of flows from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Freedom. This is an interesting one to hear from you, considering you've had your freedom completely taken away you know, I don't know if it's taken away, but so what does freedom mean to you?
You know what, freedom is such a massive one that I think a lot of people dismiss sometimes, and I feel that you don't truly appreciate freedom until you've had it taken off you. And once you've had it taken off you, you soon realize, you know, what you miss, you know. So freedom for me comes first and foremost is like freedom of thought, you know, having your imagination to go wherever you want to go and exploring all areas of life, whether it be make-believe or reality, having an imagination that allows you to go there with no restraints attached to it. the next part of freedom is free to feel the emotions that I want to feel. I'm no longer trapped in a certain negative emotion pattern. I have the freedom to feel. If I want to feel confident, I can tap into that. If I want to feel happy, I can tap into that. And if I want to feel relaxed, I can tap into that. So again, it's the freedom of choice and going through to that. And then it's more like when you tie it into like with my partner or with my family, with my friends, it's just the freedom to be with who I want to be with, do the things that we want to do, work with the clients that I want to work with, do the types of workshops and programs that I want to do. So it's just a massive freedom of choice because, like you said before, in the earlier part of my life, I was always dictated to and controlled. So And for a long time, I went along with it. And then once it's taken off you again, when you get it back, you're like, that's it. I value this so much now that I'm going to do what it is that makes me feel good. So, yeah, it's basically just the freedom of choice. But I feel that word can be thrown out there sometimes without any depth explained to it. But to me, that's what it is.
Totally. The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
Okay, so my business is called Franklin Performance Coaching. I basically do life coaching things where the techniques I use are based on the ancient healing techniques that I've told you about that can release the negative emotions and the buttons. So when we have our buttons pushed, it can release those buttons. So I help people with mental health and emotional health stuff, but it can also help for performance coaching based things. So people that want to be the best, whether it be in sports or singing or dancing or business, it can help at both ends of that. I've got a book that'll be released soon. Haven't finalized the title, but I think it'll be something along the lines of Break Free from an Emotional Prison. Book two will be released next year, which will have a lot of the stories that we touched on today. I have a full-day workshop coming up on the 29th of September at Cronulla RSL, and the workshop's going to be based on the seven domains of life, which was taught to me by the guy in prison, and that's all about aligning your goals in life with your passions and your values. Yeah, there'll be a website up and running soon, which will be Scott Frankland, so Franklin spelled Frankland.
com.au. I'll make sure it's in the show notes so people can just click through.
Cool. So that'll be up and ready shortly. And then on that, I'll have the books and the workshops. The things that I do most days of the week is the one-on-one coaching. So people come and see me in Cronulla, or I can do Skype sessions all around Australia, all over the world. So, and then the big plan next year would be get this online course up and running, because then my big, big goal is to teach the teachers. So I want to work with other coaches and other teachers and teach them the techniques in their own businesses or their own schools or family units or with their own clients. So that's the big goal.
Perfect. The takeaway. Exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
My mantra is connect to your authentic self. Like, that's my number one thing. If you don't know what it is, find out. Like, do some research, talk to some people, find what it is. It's that gut instinct. It's the heart. It's the thing that it'll guide you along your life's path, and it's never wrong. I feel that is the number one thing. If you can find what that is, it's going to lead you to the right places, to the right people. Just find what that is.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been an incredible conversation. I can't wait to get it out there. And I really appreciate you just being so open and honest about your story. Like, it's seriously a very powerful one, just metaphorically. we can all relate to it, right? Because we have all been imprisoned by our minds, I guess. And yours is just a more literal version of that. So thank you. It's a gift.
Oh, thanks heaps for having me. And I'm so grateful that you asked me to give me an opportunity to spread the message and the word. And I can see what you're doing, the powerful thing. And hopefully people hear this and relate to it, and it wakes that part up of them inside them and makes their life even better as well. So yeah, thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for tuning into Carlosophies. If you really dug this app, I'd love for you to share it with someone who you think might also dig it. It really helps me to spread the word. And if you'd like to get to know me a little better and see some in-between app thoughts and insights and be around some super cool people, join my Facebook tribe, Show Up Speak Up. Search Show Up Speak Up in Facebook or head to carlinimmo.com/tribe. Until next time, be real, be rad. Peace out.